Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have another one of our Urbanite Radio conversations. This is based on an Urbanite article, which we'll be doing several out of this article over the next month, called On the Outside, that was written by Michael Corbin, and J.M. Giordano did the photographs. And it's about men coming out of prison and the revolving door and what's happening in people's lives of ex-offenders coming out and what they struggle with. And it's really a very powerful article. It's one of the best I've read in a long time because he gets into the not just policy questions but in the heart of people's lives. And one of the folks in that article joins us this hour, Imam Earl Alameen, who's a resident imam at the Muslim Community Cultural Center of Baltimore over in Walbrook Junction. Brother Bay is with us as well. He's founder and president of the Fraternal Order of Ex-Offenders. Adam Schneider is coordinator of community relations at Healthcare for the Homeless. And Melissa Broom is senior policy advocate at the Jobs Opportunities Task Force. And welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, you know, as looking at this, and they kind of built part of the story, some of the story around two men who were released from prison. One returned, one didn't. And one of the things it's clear about this, and let's just jump into this, the heart of this thing, which is why this is just a giant revolving door. Why it is that it is concentrated in certain zip codes in Baltimore City and in Prince George's County, 13,000 people coming home every year from prison. And the recidivism rate is over 60% for those ex-offenders. And, you know, people keep wrestling with why. But let's talk about what's going on from your perspective here. And Earl, why don't you jump off and start?
Well, as you very well know, I mean, it's very important to understand that we're talking about something in America right now, the economy, and we're talking about what I call the prison industrial complex. And when I say that, we look at the areas throughout America, but here in Maryland, we would look at Western Maryland, and we would also look at the Jessup area, and we find that there's an inordinate amount of prisons. Now, those prisons fuel the economy for that area, specifically Western Maryland. And so those people that fuel the economy come from those zip codes that you had spoken about in Baltimore City and Prince George's County. This has now become, Mark, a business. And this is the thriving flesh business that is taking place now. And it is the second largest business that is in America right now. So, you know, it's very important to understand that economics is driving this also. But as it fuels the environment, let's say Western Maryland, ultimately, many of the individuals are coming back to the environment, those zip codes that they came from, and there's nothing for them there. They come back in environments that are very desolate, in a sense. Desolate, when I say desolate, they're desolate to be able to afford them the opportunity to become a productive individual.
And you know, when we started this off, Brother Bay, I said to you there were these new stats that I saw that said that at the end of this article that it said the number of black males born today who can expect to spend time in prison if trends continue is 1 out of 3. And when I read that to you, your response was, you think that's low.
Yeah, peace and blessings to the listening audience. And I'm going to ask you a question, but let me expound on what Brother Eric Alameen was saying. You know, crime in America is traditional cherry pie. Yeah. And when you talk about the criminal justice system, but it's the criminal justice system by its nature. I'm a residential criminologist. It's a form of social control. And how do people get into those places and spaces that we have primary institutions, which is the home, the school, the spiritual institutions of the community? And when little Brother Bay did not hear and obey, stayed his own way, and that's not to say all those people there are good people, then the choices that I made, I'm powerless of the consequences, I empower the law enforcement courts and corrections. And the reason that I'm saying that, because we write programs. We have a 12-step crime prevention program that deals with the psychology of sociology of criminality. So what I'm saying is that Earl said that it's a business. I would go to the next level. It says the industry, the greatest financial allocation in the United States of America is the military. Second to that is criminal justice, Department of Justice. And the reason that we need to put this in perspective, we're not relieving people of their culpability, because this is personal. It is personal. Now, having said that, when people come out of prison, you understand what I'm saying? They have certain sociological needs. And if they had utilized those needs or had those needs, they would not have made the choices that they are. And a lot of people are more comfortable in uncomfortability in the system because all their basic physiological needs are met, food, clothing, shelter, Maslow's theory hierarchy. The fact of the matter is that people need those things. The question is how do they get it, illegit or legit? Now, having said that, when we talk about these numbers, in the United States, they incarcerate more than 800 people per 100,000. But when you break that down to ethnic group, and I'm going to get into that, you understand, when you look at the white population, it's 471 per 100,000, which is much lower than the 750 to the 800. When you look in an African-American community, it is 4,841. So one of the things that we are not talking about in this process is the casteism, the classism, and the racism, because it's a no-brainer. Why is it, even in the state of Maryland, 90% of that population that's incarcerated are male, nearly 76 or 78%. So we say nearly 80% of that population is African-American males. It's a no-brainer. And I'm not saying when we do groups and we challenge folks, we tell them, look at this, how you contribute to your own demise, you invest in the criminal justice system, you don't get no dividends. It's all by design. So having said that, when you talk about, I'm not impressed with the data, we train young folks that they're liars, they're damn liars, and then they're statistics. We can manipulate statistics and say whatever we choose to make them say. And I'm going to give you the premise once I answer the question. There are more than one in every three people who may be incarcerated if we can continue the trend that we are doing right now. Most folks, when they look at the trend, it started in 1980. In the state of Maryland in 1980, they was incarcerated. The total population was 7,732.
Right.
By 2002, it was 32,000. I think it was 752 or 54. The growth. It goes back to the sociological needs. We're not relieving people. We talked about, Adam mentioned, a war on drugs. It's not a war on drugs. It's a war on people. You understand me? We have to look at the comprehensive perspective, the mental ill stuff, the economical stuff, you know, the lack of fathers in the community stuff, all of those dynamics. Because many programs try to fix individuals, and that's part of the process, but nobody deals with the cause. We say, well, this is the problem. Let's create a solution. Well, it's going to the root if you expect to change the fruit. We do not deal with causes. And I'm going to close on this note to say we have a piece that talks about the psychology and sociology of reentry slash reintegration. If I was a career criminal and I evolve out of the juvenile justice system, then I go into the adult system and I get an expiration date. I get evicted from the facility. I don't have the sociological skills. So when I come back into the community and evolve more city, we talk more zones 12, 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18. You have a high concentration of releasees, returnees, from incarceration. They go back to the same hood, do the same thing over and over again, and society expects different results. That is insanity. And I'll close on that note. All of the sociological skills that they need, whether it's a job preparation, vocational GED, et cetera, they are symptoms. The process, behavior doesn't change till the thinking change. All behaviors learn behavior. People learn what they live, and eventually they live what they learn. So we are talking about changing the mindset. I can give a paradigm, but we won't do it because it's intellectual properties. We're talking about the public health model, primary, secondary, tertiary.
You said a lot, so we got to break down some of the stuff. So let me go around the room here and come back. And Earl, I heard you trying to jump back in too, but Adam, let me bring in the conversation. I mean, part of this is initiated by what you sent over to us from Healthcare for the Homeless.
Yeah, we speaking of statistics, we this summer, some clients, interns, staff of Healthcare for the Homeless put together a research project. We've been doing this for the past several summers. And this year, looking at what was going on in the community, looking at issues that were coming before the legislature thought that an issue that's worth exploring is the connection between poverty, homelessness, incarceration, and reentry. And we interviewed about 430 different individuals who had been released from Maryland, from incarceration in Maryland, from jails and in prisons, and asked them questions about what that experience was like, what was going on in their lives beforehand, what the results were after. And to a previous point about economics being a driving factor here, what we found was that about two-thirds of the people prior to incarceration were housed, and following incarceration, that number was about one-third. So lots and lots of people following periods of incarceration are not able to access stable housing. And we know that stable housing is one of those things that reduces recidivism. If somebody has a safe place to go, they're much less likely to recidivate. We found that upon release, four in 10 were able to access employment. And as we said before, having access to a stable job is something that is a piece of stability that helps to prevent recidivism. So what we're seeing is that people are going through systems, oftentimes not able to access the services that they need even behind the wall. When they get out, you know, they're left flopping in the wind. Overwhelmingly, people were being released without a home plan that they felt effectively addressed their needs. And many of the people had said that they were released between 8 p.m. and 5 a.m. in the morning at some time in their life. And my mom always used to tell me that nothing good ever happens after 10 o'clock at night. And I think when we're releasing people who don't have a place to go, who don't have any supports, oftentimes it's amazing that we're surprised that people then struggle to survive.
And let me introduce Melissa here, Broom. Tell me a little bit first about what this is you do.
So the Job Opportunities Task Force is a nonprofit. We're located in downtown Baltimore, but we work on policy statewide. And we focus on low-wage workers and particularly helping low-wage workers advance to better jobs. So we're really all about helping people get to work and stay at work. And we care particularly about job seekers who have criminal records. I mean, I think it's impossible to have this discussion without talking about the fact that when people are released, they have to be able to get to work if we're going to keep them out of the system. Like, you need a job. And yet, we do lots of things in society to put up these barriers to employment. We know that employers across the board are just reluctant to hire you if you have any kind of a mark on your criminal record. And so we spend a lot of time trying to educate employers about, you know, the benefits to hiring folks. And I think, you know, there are so many examples of the ways our system is broken. And to give you one, I heard a story last week about a client who had come to a service provider, a friend of ours. This is a 60-year-old woman who's worked in the school system for 19 years, has been a good employee for 19 years. And through a routine background check, I guess they have to do regular background checks on school employees. A recent background check turned up a 37-year-old conviction, something this woman did 37 years ago, hasn't had any issues since, and has been an employee for 19 years, and now she's facing, she might get fired because of this conviction. And when you stop and think about that, you know, these policies don't make sense. I mean, we want people to come back to society and do the right thing. We want them to contribute. We want them to pay taxes. And yet we put up all these barriers. Another example, Baltimore City, recently a city solicitation went out, an RFP for contractors to bid on weatherization jobs, lead abatement, green jobs. And there was language in this RFP that says people who can't pass a criminal background check cannot work on the project. This is problematic for a few reasons. One, plenty of RFPs have gone out for these jobs over the years. They've never included that language. Secondly, you know, a criminal background check is not a pass-fail test, so the language doesn't even make sense. And most importantly, these are jobs that are known to be ex-offender friendly. These are jobs, I mean, these are jobs working on empty houses. So if Baltimore City is going to say that people with a criminal record can't even go and do that, then where do we expect them to go? You have lots of groups and contractors that have people on their staff who have records, who have been working, you know, under these types of contracts for years, and they're going to have to fire them if they get this contract because they can't pass a background check. So these are just some of the examples of policies that are in place that don't make sense for if we want people to do the right thing. I mean, the burden of a background, of having a blemish on your criminal background when it comes to finding a job is just, it's so tremendous, I don't even know how to put it into words.
So I wonder then, one of the things here, when I hear these discussions, and I've been doing this for the last, on the radio here, I had these discussions the last 19 years, but in my life working with communities and in prisons and in and out of prison and ex-offenders, for the last 40-odd years, that, you know, it's the same discussion. Discussion doesn't ever seem to change. You know, I mean, so is it, the question is, for me, I mean, there's an issue here of what action needs to be taken for systemic change, as well as the issues around, you know, all the great, wonderful programs to help individual ex-offenders or groups of ex-offenders find their way, find a job, get out there in the world, but none of that's going to answer any of the questions unless something larger happens that changes the systemic issues that we face. We're going to have the same conversation 20 years from now. Then it'll be one out of two black men in prison instead of what it is today.
And you're absolutely correct. And I'm going to tell you what's missing out of the equation, no pun intended, right? Everybody talks about populations. Let me use President Obama, regardless of his politics, or Dr. Ben Carson. Someone knows those names. If Joe Blow or Mrs. Sue think that they're dying from AIDS, male, female, black, or white, it really doesn't matter. The most important person that's going to have an effect on those people who think they're dying from AIDS is someone who has the courage to stand up and say that I'm living with AIDS. What am I talking about is that we got other institutions and other people becoming advocates for this population, good, bad, or indifferent, but I always incorporate the recovery model. Okay? President Obama cannot go into the Narcotics Anonymous and say, I'm the president of the United States. They look for empathy, not sympathy. And what is missing out of discussion, people do not engage those populations. All of my members are ex-offenders. All of them had experience. And one of the things that we deprogrammed them, then we reprogrammed them. And we're beyond providing the service, but we engage them and empower them, and they become the poster child for whatever they articulate. What is missing, those of us who've done the right thing for the right reason, and we come out of the suites and we're in the streets, we need to be engaged and empowered and set at tables with other folks so that we can tell them the realities of the process. I heard what Adam said about the research that they've done, and based on interviewing the population, some of them say that they were housed. I'm willing to bet if you go back to that same population, you will find out that the majority of them was homeless by federal definition. The name was not on the lease, and the name was not on the mortgage. So what I'm simply saying, we have to change paradigms. As you indicated, the same discussion is not working. We need to engage that population. We provide services, housing, transitional housing, rent them out to major organizations, and all they do, we collect the rent, and they take care of the property, et cetera. We have a transitional house right now called Recovery is Just for Me, 12 to 14 men. And even though they have stable place to stay, they're caught up in their disease thinking that caused their disease. We need to, this population has been in a war that they created. And what you do with prisoners of war, you debrief them. And the other thing that I'm hearing, even with the legislation, we was down in Annapolis Friday, right? And one of the things that we challenged the legislation, you can make all the legislation you want, but does it become dry bones in the violet, as the Bible would say? Because we had the 1964 Civil Rights Act, 1965 Voting Rights Act, 1968 Fair Housing Act. Look at all these populations that you're talking about. They can't vote. Most of them boxed out of voting. You know, we the industry language is collateral damages and legal barriers. We have members who've been in recovery 10 years, been out on the street 10 years, had a job, lost a job, go apply for another job. Then they look at his record, got to face it all over again. He has lost his house, lost his car, and he's a single parent. The problem is for me as an ex-offender, and I heard how long you've been doing this work, and God bless you. I'd be 65 my next year birthday. I've been dealing with the criminal justice system since I was 10. Thank God in every capacity known as a resident criminal. I've changed my life. I've changed my thinking. I've changed my behavior. And we challenge those populations and we show them what the system is about. We write programs, and one of them's called Living to Avoid the Criminal Justice System. Well, we send them through, Well, we put them through a process, and they see how they contribute to their own demise, and stop pointing fingers at Officer Unfriendly. If you ain't got them 10 pills, you ain't got to worry about Officer Unfriendly.
I think, Brother Bay, there's two things that you said that I think of tantamount importance. One is that you have to change the thinking, and then what you just said, how to avoid the system. So now I'm back to square one because what I'm looking at is how do we stop Tavon from going into the system? And so I think that is, Mark, you said that we'll be back with that same conversation. We will come back with the same conversation if, in fact, we don't put our energies and our resources in on the front end. It's the old tram oil filter syndrome. Either you pay now or you pay later. So if we can catch the individuals before they come into the system, then we don't have to worry about them going through the system. If, in fact, we do what we're supposed to do on the front end of the system. But we have to understand that the system is designed, like I said, this is business here. This is a big multi-billion-dollar business now that runs people through the system and then runs them back out through the system so that they can come back. It's nothing but a revolving door. So how, like Brother Bay is saying, we must educate these young people before they even encounter the juvenile and the criminal justice system so that they won't be able to be victims of that system and to benefit other people in the society so that they can live good. You see? So I think that's very, very important. We've got to, you know, we spend, even in the juvenile justice system, when you look at it, they're getting ready to build another institution, but they're not putting any money in prevention on the front end or diversion, but they're putting tons of money on the back end. Why? Because there's no sincerity there to really help to kill the system. The system should be, I mean, I would love to say 20 years from now that, hey, man, there's 10% of the kids that are going in the system now as it was related to 20 years ago, how many kids were going into the system. So I think, you know, the front end is the most important piece for us now. How do we, through policy, through community activism, how are we successful in doing these things on the front end? Because you're not going to be able to manifest anything for these young men coming out of the system. Because I'm a vice president of a human services organization that employs 650 people. In the past 2.5 years, we were up to 30% of our people were ex-offenders. Now, in the past 2.5 years, we've seen a drop in these employments because for ex-offenders, because now the rules state that we can't employ certain people, and even in human services where these people flourish. These people were flourishing working with developmentally disabled adults, working with kids in residential services, in foster care kids. They had a human sensitivity to work in this environment. They weren't making tons of money, but the rewards were much better for them because they saw themselves improving the lives of others. So that's part of policy that we have to work on. But also, like I said, we have to work on in neighborhoods and in communities. We have to We have to find a way to educate these young people that, hey, look, you can, if you go in the system, this is what's going to happen, like Brother Bay would say.
No, Brother Mark, let me quickly say this. One of the things we talk about solutions, we have a 12-step crime prevention program. We go in DJS, and I'm going to say something that Eric alluded to. In the state of Maryland, this is not to knock individuals. I'm talking about processes. That's why they box us up, because we tell the truth and shame the devil. They spend $17,000 per head to educate a child. Let that child transgress the law, get apprehended and adjudicated. They spend $100,000 to $150,000 to warehouse them in a residential facility. If they have to exile them to another state, they'll spend $200,000 to $250,000. We got young folks, parents who are calling us. They went in at 17, stayed 6 or 8 months. They come back out. They got a baby now, and they tell us the streets are calling them. No wraparound services. Something's wrong with the equation. We in the school systems, right? And we deal with Bloods, Crip, Piru, BGF, et cetera, et cetera. And they respect us, right? Because we have an innovative, unconventional, creative methodology. They know that we're not intimidated, awed, impressed. Some of the young folks, you know how we connect with them? Just by knowing the environment that they came out of and naming folks right then and there, we could connect with them. So we have to change our paradigm. And I'm going to say this in closing. Foxhole doesn't have a panacea. We need the people just like you who represent them, other organizations, to know that we have hands-on with that population and they take our suggestions and our directions and they will come an advocate for the legislative, whether it's Senator Pugh or whoever. Too often we operate in silos.
We do. And I, when we come back from this break, I want to talk about getting out of the silo and about both the kind of stuff that happens that has to happen on the ground, but some of that has to happen with legislative change, and some of it has to happen with kind of direct action by people coming out of their silos who believe in the same thing to demand this kind of change. So we'll come back and wrestle with that to have another one of Urbanite Radio stories focusing on this article written on ex-offenders called On the Outside. We'll be right back.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.
I'm Mark Steiner. I'm sitting here with Brother Bay, founder and president of the Fraternal Order of Ex-Offenders. Adam Schneider is coordinator of community relations at Healthcare for the Homeless. Melissa Broom is senior policy advocate for Job Opportunities Task Force. Imam Earl El Amin is resident imam at the Muslim Community Cultural Center of Baltimore, and is also in his other life active in working with ex-offenders and people in all parts of our society. So in looking at this, you said as we were going to break, Brother Vader, we have to come out of our silos, was the word you used. And this, and again, this is a two or three track thing here for me as we look at this. One has to do with what has to change, mm-hmm. and who pushes to make that change, to make the world different for people coming out of prison. The other has to do with the kind of things that where money can be changed, I mean, where you can change what we invest and how we do it. They have in certain states in this article. It was interesting. They were talking about this program called Justice Reinvestment that they're doing in many other states, where instead of incarcerating people, they're taking the money that we use for incarcerating people and putting it into programs at the front end and in rehab programs and in kind of programs that Brother Bay runs or like Baltimore Station, other places that really where men and women go in and lives come out differently, and that's where they put the money. So the question is, what has to change and how do we change it? You know, how do we change it?
Let's focus on reentry. There's a gap in reentry.
So let me go to here first and come back because we haven't heard. Adam? Yeah, and Melissa.
Well, one of the things that we saw in the study that we did was the number of people who were incarcerated for the first time very, very young. So one-third of the people that we interviewed were incarcerated for the first time before they were 18. Two-thirds were incarcerated before they were 24. And when we looked at how long people spent behind the wall when they were incarcerated at different times for the first time, the number of the length of time that people who were incarcerated under for the first time under the age of 18 was extraordinary. 68% of the people who were incarcerated before 18 spent over 10 years of their life in jail or prison. So I think that early intervention is important in figuring out how do we create and invest in systems that work on the preventative end, and then how do we ensure that services are available for people who are incarcerated? How do we ensure that services are available afterwards? You pointed out, Mark, that we're seeing more and more people. The problem is getting worse, not better. 30 years ago, we had a federal prison population of about 300,000. Today, it's over 2 million. And, you know, any time that we engaged in some struggle and we have this profound level of failure, what we really do need to do is be asking what strategies and tactics ought we be using, because the ones that we are aren't. One of the things that we think are really important is ensuring that people have access to housing, have access to employment, and access to all of the supportive services that they need, because those are the things that not only does research say prevents incarceration, but also the people that we interviewed, when we asked them what are the things that would have most helped prevent you to be incarcerated, the top three things were employment, housing, and then health and social services. And if we can be providing those, I think that we can start to reduce these rates of incarceration. Stop building prisons and start building housing. Start investing in schools. Start putting people to work.
I think one of the things we immediately have to do is people en masse have to demand we don't need another prison built, period, in Maryland or anywhere in America. But Melissa, can you talk to the jobs that people cannot get? What are the jobs that people are denied? What kinds of jobs are they denied if they come out of prison?
I mean, all kinds of jobs. Like I said, you're getting denied jobs to go and work in an empty house. You can get denied a job at McDonald's. I mean, we're not just talking about high level, super fancy jobs. People are getting denied warehouse jobs. People are getting denied construction jobs.
So there's no specific law saying you can't have this construction job. Like, there are laws that say that a woman who comes out of prison cannot be a cosmetologist.
Well, that gets into licensing issues.
Which is insane.
Which, there has been some work done around that. But I think, when you talk about employment and the fact that you let's say you're incarcerated for a certain number of years, or you go and you spend 5 years and you do your time. You think you've done your time, but you come out and this criminal record now lives with you for the rest of your life. Even though you only did a year, maybe you did 6 months, maybe you didn't even go to jail, but you still have a conviction. It follows you for the rest of your life.
Right.
So I think it's really important to have a conversation in Annapolis, and not just have a conversation, but demand attention to these issues. And we need to be creating some kind of a movement. We need to be making sure that these issues are at the forefront of legislators' minds, because no matter where you fall on these issues, it is a public safety issue. It's a public safety issue when people can't go to work and can't live productive lives. So we, there are lots of plenty of advocates in Annapolis every year, but we need to do more. And like Brother Bay said, we need to hear from the people themselves who are affected by these issues. We need their stories in Annapolis. There will be legislation this year. For the third year in a row, the Ban the Box bill will be back. So the Ban the Box issue has to do with getting the question off of state job applications that asks you to check a box if you've ever been convicted of a crime. Right, we know what happens when you're filling out a job application and you check that box. You're not going to be called in for an interview. So the idea behind Ban the Box is let's get the question off the application so that the most qualified people are brought in for the interview. Let's make sure people can at least get in front of the hiring manager and talk about talk about the issue. The state can still run the background check. They can still ask you if you've ever been convicted of a crime. But you get the chance to talk about it and explain how you've rehabilitated yourself or how that was something you did a long time ago and you know, you can still be a good worker. You get to make a case for yourself rather than having your application go in the trash before you even get your foot in the door. You know, we want the state to do this and to set an example for private employers. There's a real national movement around this issue. Baltimore City, we were successful in getting Baltimore City to remove the box a few years ago. But this will be the third year that that bill is coming back to Annapolis.
So ban the box bill. Yeah, that's absolutely
right. Go ahead, Earl.
Then
we'll go to Brother Beg. Earl, go ahead.
A few years ago, we were having problems because here at the National Center of Institutional Alternatives, we run residential services. We have residential services. And many of the people that were residential counselors at that time were people who were ex-offenders. But one of the things that we found out was what was happening, because they had to distribute medications to some of the clients, you had to be certified through the Board of Nursing. And this is an example of what we were talking about. We had to go to Annapolis to meet with a prominent delegate who had some sway over the Board of Nursing. Because the first question on the Board of Nursing's application was, before we got ahead of removal, have you ever been arrested? Not have you ever been convicted, but have you ever been arrested? So if, in fact, you have been arrested but you hadn't been convicted and you filled out that blank and said, yeah, I've been arrested before, you didn't have a snowball's chance to even get employment. This is what she's talking about, I think, also. It's a deep-seated thing with trying to find employment for people. And what they've done now through the laws, and when I say, Mark, I'm back to this reactionary thing. What mm-hmm. happens in Annapolis with if in fact some guy is an ex-offender and he puts his hands on one of the clients and it comes out in the Sun paper, and so what happens is there's a scramble for everybody to cover their butt. And everybody covers their butt, so all of these agencies that are the funding sources, what they do is they come in and they scan all the whoever is employed and anybody that has a record, then they subsequently lose their job. Now, because of the act of one individual. And this has happened over and over and over again. As she is saying, we have to advocate in Annapolis that stop being a punitive society. This should be a redemptive society. It purports itself to be. Now, if in fact the individual is an ex-offender, served their time, that's it. We want the individual to become a productive human being in the society. But we're still labeling people and holding them to their past. And that has to stop.
I've been in every institution in the state of Maryland, Miami, Philadelphia, New York, other spaces and places, naming law books. So I'm speaking from an empirical perspective. I read all the data. I live this, and what I do is therapeutic for me, because if I stop doing this, I'll be just like those other folks who recidivate. See, we need to change paradigms. One of the things we do not do, we don't talk about. If I say the ex-offenders that we engage, if you create a venue, I can bring them there. And one of the things we hear all the time, I'll say this, not to indict, the rec center, 5,000 people go through there per year or more. But because there's no relationships, they can't bring 50 that says, I went through your process, I've done A, B, C, X, Y, Z, I become the poster child, I become the magnet, I come and draw. We got to sit back at the table and start from zero. Solution, we're talking about incarceration and we're talking about reentry. The reentry, the program called reentry, once again, as a student of criminology, has gaps in it. It goes behind the fence 6 months prior to a person being released. I'm not talking about the quality. I'm talking about gaps. Our research indicates more, and Eric knows this, more than 85% of the population that is under the auspices of the criminal justice system is not in a facility, even though they're emotionally, spiritually, economically, and mentally incarcerated. They're on parole, probation, being sought on an outstanding warrant. They're in our community. We had the vision with no money to create a program called Project Peace. Peace means proper education always correct error, because we know they're in our communities. And when we talk about, I heard somebody say we need early intervention. Intervention is after the fact. We need prevention comes before intervention. When you look at the public health model, pre-entry is about creating safe environments. We move from public safety, because when people in the community hear public safety, they think about the police. The police does what it does. It's not social workers. We're talking about primary prevention is creating safe environments. Y'all want to fix Brother Bay, but you don't fix the environments that create Brother Bays. Secondary prevention, meaning reducing harms. You can tell I'm studying this. I don't read notes. It's in my DNA, chromosome, genetic material, and it is painful. Tertiary is managing crisis. So what we are saying, we can learn from each other, but we don't do that. We act like OGs. We have a set. We are territorial. You understand what I'm saying? I know, and I had personal experience, Brother Eric, Alameen. You give me a job, my thinking don't change. I save my quarters and go to New York and bring a package back that'll pay me more than any other job.
Absolutely.
It ain't about giving those externals. You got to deal with us internal. You give me a transition house, recovery house, and you know this, Brother Earl. If my thinking don't change, I turn it into the coke house, the dope house, the prostitution house.
Absolutely.
All of those externals don't fix people. What
Absolutely.
Fixes people when you have a methodology that you can get self-disclosure and they understand how they contribute to their own demise. You go to Congress now, you see it right here. We're going to have a letter. Our lawyer sent them an assist and decease letter. Now they're talking about reentry, a no entry. This was done in 2005, copyright.
I remember.
We got the process that would engage that population where they become advocates for self, because Eric, and I'm going to close with this. In 1992, your center did a study in Baltimore City. It says 56% of the African-American males between the age 18 and 35 years old is under the auspices of the criminal justice system. Proximity, Chocolate City, D.C., the only thing changed was 44%. In that population, you had 100% of that population, 18 to 35 years old. It does not include the juveniles. And closing, when you talked about 2.5 million under that's incarcerated, that does has nothing to do with the 13 million more so that's released from jails on a daily basis. I say if we really want to get some outcomes out of the input, you understand what I'm saying, and the income, you need to sit down at the table. All of us become first among equals. I need to learn about your methodology, learn about yours. I know people right now that need the resources. If we come together on one accord, then we will be able to change the paradigms.
And I think that's excellent, Brother Bay. But I know that you love me, and I love you, and that and you loved my late brother. But I know that everybody knew that we were twins, but I'm Earl, not Eric.
I'm a senior citizen. I had a senior moment. My bad. I ain't got no backup in here. My bad.
But I think that, Brother Bay, please, you hit on something, Mark, and this is very important. When we were interviewed, Mr. Corbin came to interview us, and we were interviewed, one of the things that I said, and I said, look, this is not about, you can't program your way out of this. This is about developing community and family life. First and foremost, if we develop model neighborhoods, then we have an opportunity to engage the individual at that level before, as he said, that's the prevention model. The prevention model is model neighborhoods and model communities. Mm-hmm. If we're able to do those types of things, develop 4 and 5 blocks where people, there's a peaceful environment. People enjoy coming into that environment. They can get all of their basic needs met in those environments. Then we're really on to something then. But to keep hopping on the individuals coming back out of the system, as he said, he's absolutely correct. As he said, look, we got to change the way an individual thinks. And if we don't change the way an individual thinks, a job means nothing. You see, a job does not mean anything if, in fact, the individual does not change the way they think. You have to change the thinking pattern of the individual so that they can see that they can be a productive citizen in the society.
But I also think that it's important not to ignore the fact that even if we change people's thinking, if they can't get a job that's productive, then, you know, they're going to be in a tough, tough situation, right? We need to survive. And right now, one out of five people in Baltimore City live in poverty. 40% of children in Baltimore City live in poverty. If we're not talking about poverty, if we're not talking about the structural causes, I'm inclined to think that the incarceration rate, this era of mass incarceration, is a symptom of much deeper problems that are related to issues of poverty, that are related to the lack of work that's meaningful for people, the breakdown in community. We've got tremendous investment some places in the city and a dearth of investment other places. And unless we start looking at these broad, I would say more fundamental issues, we're going to be just addressing symptoms and not fundamental problems.
Melissa
was trying to say something earlier.
I was just going to say that we know, or the latest, I know it's a shame to keep talking about statistics, but the latest numbers from the National Employment Law Project are that one in four Americans has a criminal record, one in four. So that's a reality that we need to face. That's 25% of the population. You know, when they're going to apply for jobs, they have to deal with this. And the way our system is set up right now, once you get a conviction on your record, you can't ever get rid of it. So I mentioned the Ban the Box bill, but I want the listeners to know that we're hoping to have legislation this session also dealing with the shielding of criminal records and looking at, thinking about there's overwhelming research that shows that your likelihood to recidivate declines the longer you stay clean. And that if you're going to recidivate, you're almost guaranteed to do it in the first 3 to 5 years after you're released from incarceration. So why then is a 37-year-old conviction keeping someone from getting a job or causing them to lose their job? That's right, madness. So we're hopeful that there's going to be legislation looking at starting to shield, making it possible to shield certain records from employers so that you don't have to walk into an interview or disclose that on a job application. And we need help. Like this is not – in Massachusetts in 2010, they were successful in doing this massive overhaul of the way they look at criminal records and what can be shielded and banning the box and all of this. And they did it by bringing hundreds and thousands of people on a daily basis to their capital to have this outcry to their legislature about why something needs to be done. And that's what we need. That is the kind of thing we're going to need here if we're going to have any success in changing some of these laws. So if anyone's interested, anyone's listening who has a story to tell or who would be interested in helping with this, go to jotf.org and send us an email. Because
JOTF.org.
It's jotf.org, JOTF for Job Opportunities Task Force.org. And, we want you to call us. We want to hear from you. And we want to know, how we can work with you so that your story is one of the many that will be shared, in January when we go to Annapolis and start talking about this issue. We've never had shielding legislation. We've never had this discussion. And it's going to be controversial. We need to make the case for why you shouldn't have to carry these convictions, why you shouldn't have
right.
to.
Let me interject quickly, if I may. I need to clear up something, right? When we don't know better, we can't do better. I'm here to tell you, and Earl can tell you too, that data that says within 2 to 3 years, a person is subject to recidivate. Because we are connected to people, including myself, it didn't take me 2 to 3 years to recidivate, commit another crime. It took 2 to 3 years for law enforcement to catch me. See, I'm not speaking about what somebody else writes. I'm talking about my life.
You heard that,
Earl. We engage the other people. I hear all things because I'm in a program that teaches me to learn to listen and listen to learn. And if we keep selling that, no pun intended, that nonsense by experts who don't have no experience in what they're talking about, then the population feeds on that. You know the dope fiend mentality, Earl. They will get away with that. And I'm saying we have to challenge people. We could talk law. We need law. We need jobs. We need powers. We have it. But the greatest capital is human capital. And the population is beyond telling this story. We have a magazine that had it for 5, 7 years called Think This Destiny, a radio program, a DV, a recovery CD. What we do, we empower people because they don't care about Brother Bay having two
two college degrees. They don't care what I know. They want to know that I care. And how do we show them that we care? We provide services that they need and hold them accountable.
So I think that, I mean, I think that this kind of, to me, feeds into each other, though.
Yeah, it's a balance.
Yeah.
It's about, I think there's about, it's a balance there. We've got to find, that was, like you said, Brother Bay, that's part of the silo. If we come together like this, then we can, there's a balance there. There is a need for that type of advocacy in Annapolis. There's a need for the programs, but there's a need for someone to support these brothers coming out in the homeless capacity. So there is a balance there. There has to be a balance there. For us in order to be successful, I think.
Priority just got to be people. And
it's, you know, and when we, and I was interested in what you were saying earlier, Adam, again, when we talk about kind of perspective on where the world is in all this, when we say one out of five people in Baltimore lives in poverty, the reality is it's more like 2.5 people of everybody in Baltimore lives in poverty, because we still define poverty by this ridiculous 1964
Indeed.
Definition from the war on poverty,
right,
that has no bearing to reality. I mean, there was an article today in the New York Times about that they wanted to redo what they thought poverty was, so that a woman who makes $18,000 a year but gets food stamps and other benefits from federal government is no longer considered in poverty. So, I mean, poverty is like, it's crazy.
Right. We all know that an individual making $12,000 a year is not middle class. A family making $25,000 a year is not middle class, right? They are struggling, absolutely.
So, I mean, it seems to me it's a combination of everything we've talked about here in the air. Thinking about what Brother Bay said about getting out of silos and connecting to each other's worlds and kind of dealing with what we have here, whether it's fighting in what JOTF is talking about in terms of changing legislation to give people a greater chance to get a job, to raising awareness and health care for the homeless, to Brother Bay's intense work in changing the paradigm and thinking of men and women who come out of prison and also how society deals with them, and the kind of work that Earl does in pulling all these resources together. Adam,
And I think it's also looking at when we have laws that make criminals out of one out of four, we need to maybe look at some of the laws, because laws that make criminals out of 25% of the people in this country, those laws maybe need to be reexamined. So it's not just about doing the prevention and the reentry work effectively, but it's also taking a look at the laws that are criminalizing a tremendous number of people in our communities. And as Brother Bay said, and Glenn Lowry has said, and Michelle Alexander have pointed out, that they are really connected to poverty and race. And as long as that's going on, we need to be looking at those issues as
Here's
well.
Difference.
We have 1 minute, Brother Bay. Literally, 1 minute.
I'll do 10 seconds. The fact of the matter, our research indicates that 80% of the households in Baltimore City is hit by females with children between the age of 5 to 10 years old that is living in poverty. One of the things, and I'm not trying to act like I'm the second coming or nobody, but we know this. We out there in the community, on the pulse, you understand me? We got young folks who are in wheelchairs who walk with us, and we would bring them to people. And when I talk about a jobs task force, you know what they ask me? How many people have they hired? So we have to deal with this population's mentality, whether we agree with or not, and build relationships with them. Because people got game. They come from game, and they recognize game, and it has nothing to do with individual. It's us against them mentality. Is that right, Brother Earl? That's their mentality.
Well, there is a mentality of the street.
That's their mentality.
It's a mentality of the street.
You have to empower these people. They will do your work.
Folks, this has been a really interesting, lively, and important discussion. I want to thank all of you for taking your time with our listeners here in the Steiner Show, Mark Steiner Show, and WEAA. Brother Bay, founder and president of Fraternal Order of Ex-Offenders. Adam Schneider, coordinator of community relations at Healthcare for the Homeless. Melissa Broom, senior policy advocate at Job Opportunities Task Force. And Imam Earl El Amin, resident imam at the Muslim Community Cultural Center of Baltimore over in Walbrook Junction. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.